There are any number of favorite memories that I have of Brother Marshall Keeble. I heard him first as a boy in Denver, Colorado, in a debate with a Seventh-day Adventist preacher named Nickel John. I was fascinated by Brother Keeble's presentation of his lessons during that debate, and had always enjoyed hearing him in gospel meetings. One of the things I thought stood out so much was his practice of depending upon the Bible, upon the reading of the Bible. And as many of you remember, he had a unique way of dealing with that practice, the reading from the Bible. He had a brother appointed who stood with the Bible and at Brother Keeble's instruction read one passage or another as Brother Keeble called for it. And I can still remember Brother Keeble as he called, "Brother Boatwright, read 1 Corinthians 1, verse 18. Brother Boatwright would stand on the other side of the room or the tent, as the case may have been. He'd read from that passage. Brother Keeble would use it and the truth stated in it to oppose false doctrine of one kind or another. But at the conclusion of any consideration of a point, Brother Keeble would say, "The Bible is right. The Bible is right." That thought impressed any number of people during the lifetime of Brother Marshall Keeble. He was a highly successful evangelist, a man with not a great deal of formal education, but a born psychologist, a man who knew people and how to deal with people, how to reach people. And that theme repeated so often during the course of his life, "The Bible is right," has stayed with me across the years. The Bible is right. Whether we're dealing with spiritual, with moral, or with ceremonial matters, in the Old Testament or the New Testament, the Bible is right. Or whether we deal with other matters as well, whether they have to do with medical sciences, with scientific affairs, or with social matters, the Bible is right. One of the most fascinating books that we have in the library at the present time is one authored by the son-in-law of our sister Cordray, Brother Kenny Barfield. Brother Barfield has been for a number of years working with the Mars Hill Bible School in Huntsville, Alabama, or out from Huntsville. And in the course of his work, has written a book that he called "The Bible is One." The thesis of his work is an investigation of the sacred writings of the world,
the world's great religions, considered in the light of Scripture. He has investigated various areas, whether we're dealing with religious matters, with medical affairs, with social affairs, with scientific matters. He has thought of what the world's religions present in those various fields, and then has brought to bear upon them the light of the Word of God itself. And he begins by setting forth this aim that he has. Since surely the being capable of producing the universe would understand the laws by which it was made, and any revelations from that being would also demonstrate a deep and almost prophetic comprehension of those universal laws that we come to accept as truth. We might well wonder if there could be among all the so-called revelations of the world's religions one document that is untouched by the foibles and fallacies of men, one record that reveals an accurate understanding of man and nature, one collection of writings that holds an immutable relationship to scientific truth. One book, and only one, can meet these qualifications. It is known as the Bible. And then Brother Barfield sets his purpose. "We shall isolate various fields of science, note the error-plagued ideas that saturated the cultures of the biblical times, observe that these errors found their way into the sacred books of the non-Hebraic Christian religions, and examine the Bible
to determine whether biblical writers absorb the same errors as their contemporaries. The book is a veritable encyclopedia. Manifests a great deal of work on the part of Brother Barfield. And I know that everyone in this audience would appreciate it if you take the time to investigate it. There will be more than you can handle in any short time, certainly. And in thinking about it tonight and some of the ideas that are set forth, we'll only be able to hit certain of the high spots. As a matter of fact, we won't be able to get into the majority of the things discussed by Brother Barfield. But there are some things that I find to be just fascinating. As I read the religious writings of ancient times and see some of the same errors that existed in the world about them put forth in those writings, suggesting that there is no hint of divine inspiration in any one of them. And that becomes apparent as we consider them. Brother Barfield calls attention to the scientific ideas that existed, and especially in the field of medicine, in the land of Egypt during ancient times. And on the basis of writings of various travelers through the area and various other thinkers, he acknowledges that Egypt made more advances in terms of medical knowledge than many of the countries around, well, as a matter of fact, anywhere else in the known world at that time. Yet for all the advances that were made, the lion's share of Egypt's medical arts consisted of fruitless rituals that in many instances intensified disease rather than cured it. One scholar has claimed that only 3 out of every 10 children born into a family could survive to adulthood in a land where the average age was only 30. That's how far they had advanced medically. There were two primary sources of medical knowledge in the land of Egypt, that is, according to what we've been able to discover. 2 papyri were found in Thebes in the year 1862. Ebers and Edwin Smith papyri. Combined, they measured nearly 25 meters in length. They comprised 1/2 the manuscript evidence available on the medical science of the early Egyptians. Now, the Edwin Smith papyrus, though rich in surgical material, says little about internal disease, and many of its medical recommendations would be those that anyone with a penchant for medicine would arrive at by common observation. But the Ebers papyrus ventures into the field where mere observations were not enough to produce accurate knowledge if you're thinking of the causes and the remedies of disease. And the result is the existence of some frightening prescriptions. The remedy for those with the trembling of the limbs, for example. You take the fruit of the dom palm, garlic, honey, copper, and verdigris. After the mixture has been consumed, a dog's hide is to be placed over the patient, and he's to be delivered up to the gods for healing. Probably the most revolting remedy found in the Pharmacopoeia of the physicians of the Nile, however, has to do with their prescribed treatments of infantile diseases. For some mysterious reason, baby mice were believed to be protectors of children. Therefore, when other prescriptions failed to cure sick children, the physicians skinned baby mice and gave them to the infants to be consumed whole. They also practiced what's known as the doctrine of signatures. This was a practice widely accepted in the time, not only in Egypt, but in various other countries of the world, in which physicians were advised to look for drugs that had a physical resemblance to the ailment or the afflicted organ, whatever it might be. In other words, a plant or a flower that looked somewhat like a human ear would be used to treat earache. You take a yellow plant, it would be used to treat jaundice because that has a way of turning people somewhat yellow. Or you could get red berries if you were dealing with a red rash on the skin. And that was what was called the doctrine of signatures. You found a signature of the disease or the affliction in something that looked like it in the world of plants or herbs or whatever. If an Egyptian suffered a battle wound in a war, and that battle wound was caused by a spear, you looked for a leaf that had somewhat the shape of the head of that spear, and you used that to doctor the wound of the man who'd been injured. And all of the major world cultures in those early days seemed equally impressed with this medically barren idea. Now, when you think about where diseases come from, they had a pretty good idea about that. They came from witchcraft. And disease was associated with witchcraft. And based on the records in the papyri, the tombs, and the monuments that can be found from that ancient land, there's the revelation that the Egyptians were careful about concealing anything that might have been a part of their person. They feared that even a drop of blood, a hair, or a clipping of a toenail, it could fall into the hands of wizards, and they could bring on diseases. A wizard, they believed, could take any part of a person's body. It didn't make a difference how large or how small it was. He could take that part, say a toenail clipping, put it in a lump of wax, mold the wax into a person's image, expose that image to fire, and then fever would develop. Well, we say surely people weren't taken in by anything like that. Yes, they were. During the 13th century B.C., the superintendent of Ramses' cattle was found guilty of paralyzing some of the friends of the Pharaoh through this very practice. In other words, he'd taken a part of the body of one of these friends of Pharaoh, put it in a lump of wax, shaped it into the image of the person. Automatically, disease comes. At least he paid the price, because they accused him and found him guilty of that. Now, it was during times like these that Moses began to compile the records that later became the five books of the Pentateuch of the Old Testament. And we'll think about that a little bit more later on. But in Babylon, people there had some rather unattractive drugs. They followed the doctrines of signatures. And they were also obsessed with the idea that all disease was produced by the demons or evil spirits that could be found throughout society. They taught that disease-producing specters lurked in mountains, infested plains, waited beside rivers and roads, and concealed themselves on roofs. Then the very minute that people found disfavor with their gods, those disease-bearing spirits pounced. They were treated with swine's fat, with dog's dung, and other sorts of excrements and urine. It was surmised that these treatments would disgust the demon, and he would leave for some more palatable place. Now, these were the ideas that prevailed. Their methods of diagnosis were interesting. They depended a great deal upon liver divination, or upon casual phenomena such as dreams or movement of animals or freak births. And then, of course, astrology. And the methods they had of dealing with the problems they found were amulets, incantations, or substitutions. They wore what we would call little charms around to ward off evil spirits, just like some people, incidentally, still do today. But in connection with any kind of healing process, there were always a series of incantations, just the reciting of various words or chants. And then there was the matter of substitution. Now, here's an individual who's sick. They found out by one of these methods looking into the liver of a newly killed sheep, seeing the various contours of the flesh, determining that the illness, although not connected in any way with the sheep's liver, must be such and such a thing. They've tried the amulets, they've tried the incantations. Now they come to the substitution. They take a piglet and put him right up against the patient and then tear his heart out, press it against the heart of the patient, smear blood on both sides of the cot where the patient lies, and hope that he's going to be healed. Now, these were some of the practices that were used in those days. China had something of the same idea. They had so many of the same errors that we've already talked about. And the early Chinese medical practices included demonology, divination, alchemy, and various forms of magic. And that alchemy was an interesting thing. They took a number of different minerals, mixed them all together, and consumed them. Some of them very powerful, and some of them the very thing the human beings didn't need. One man went to a great deal of work to determine just how many Chinese emperors might have been shuffled off unduly by the use of alchemy. The consumption of these minerals mixed together with a mistaken notion that they were going to be healed. Well, these were some of the ideas that existed in the realm of medical science in ancient times. And the question comes, did those ideas make their way into the sacred writings of the world's great religions? Are they to be found there? Well, the Hindu system of medicine is known as Ayurveda, the science of life, and is included in the sacred writings, the Atharva Veda. And that's the chief source of Vedic medicine. It consists of about 100 hymns, and they were intended as cures for diseases. Now, they are the oldest Hindu writings that deal with this matter of disease. But right along in line with the erroneous teachings of the day, their authors ascribe all disease to supernatural demonic powers that enter the body. Some of these demons take the form of worms and the cause of headaches, as well as diseases of the eye and of the ear. Still others singled out the victims on the basis of sin in their previous life. Thus, a mortal sinner automatically became a leper. An alcoholic automatically had black teeth. And one who killed a cow would be struck blind. This is the medical science that appears in the sacred writings, the religious writings of the Hindus. The Buddhist writings manifest something of the same thing. Medical references are really almost non-existent because the Buddhists believe that the body is really not worth much and that the striving or the yearning of every individual ought to be to achieve nothingness. Well, anybody who seriously believes that's not going to be too concerned about taking medical steps to prolong life or to make it even more worthwhile. In the Taoist writings, we have very little of lasting value. That is, in the light of what we regard as modern medical research. They believed in alchemy. They believed in the use of charms and talismans. In short, someone has said the Taoist writings hindered the progress of medicine in ancient China for many centuries. Zoroastrian writings, same thing, attributed all diseases to demons who were wandering through the land searching for victims. But embedded in these scriptures is a prohibition against burying the dead. And here it is. The text reads, "A sin for which there is no atonement." The burying of the dead. The reason? A corpse placed in the earth would render the earth unclean and thereby produce disease through crops that receive their nourishment from the soil. In the Islamic writings, not too much of medical concepts. They come, of course, much later than any of these others. Some progress had been made in medical science before Muhammad wrote the Quran, but not very much given there. But in non-Jewish and non-Christian writings, that is, not inspired writings, what do we find? Even though religious, sacred, the eyes of many scriptures, they were filled with misconceptions and inaccuracy. Josephus, for example, the historian of New Testament times, believed that demons could be expelled through a patient's nose and then be forced to overturn cups of water to demonstrate that they were leaving. Now, that was Josephus' idea. Well, what about medicine in the Bible? What do we find of the medical arts as far as the Word of the Lord is concerned? There are two questions that are important to us, of course. The first is, do the Bible writers avoid the errors that ensnared all of these others? In the scientific climate of the day, do we see brought over into the Bible the ideas that were prevalent at the time certain books, especially the Old Testament, were written? The second question, are some statements so advanced that in the light of what we know today, the human authors of those statements could not have recognized their significance? But now, if the Bible is inspired, if it is the Word of God, we would expect the answer to be in the affirmative. Because we're thinking of a being who has not only created the universe and man, but is acquainted with all of the laws that govern the operation of both the universe and man. And so in answer to the first question, we have an overwhelming yes. Thorough study of the Bible will yield not one abominable prescription. Not one of these prescriptions. And this is just one or a few among thousands of prescriptions that we find in these religious writings of the great world religions. Not one of them appears anywhere in the Bible. Now that's amazing, because many of the books of the Bible were written during the very time when medical science was suffering through some of its darkest days. And yet somehow the biblical writers did not bring over into the Bible these ideas that we've considered. Now, many erroneous ideas were originated when the Ebers papyrus that are referred to in Egypt was accessible and was in vogue. That was in the land of Egypt. That was during the days of Moses. Many scholars put Moses in the period of the Middle Kingdom in ancient Egypt. And that was the very time when the Ebers papyrus was accepted by the majority of people there. We read in Acts 7th chapter, the 22nd verse, of course, that Moses was educated in all the wisdom of the Egyptians. And in all likelihood, he would have come into contact with some of these various ideas that we thought about because they were popular and readily accepted there. But strangely enough, from the very beginning of the Pentateuch, from the very beginning of Genesis, to the end of the Pentateuch, there is not one reference to any such cures as animal or human excrement, or the gall of tortoise, or the heel of an Abyssinian greyhound, or the burnt quill of a hedgehog. These were all acceptable cures during that time. There's no reference that attributes disease to demons or that teaches alchemy or astrology. One writer has said the Hebrew nation was probably the first people to disbelieve that diseases were caused by evil spirits and demons. Now, the Bible writers do occasionally mention demons, and all of us are familiar with that. But there's a major difference. The Bible authors never suggest or imply that demons were the only cause of sickness. When mentioned, the demons are described as afflicting the mind, which of course in turn caused physical problems. But we notice in the second place that biblical authors severely restrict the power of demons. That is, they're not dealing with unlimited power on the part of the demonic world. And the Bible authors imply that demon involvement in human affairs, of which we do read, was for a limited time. What else happens when we think about medical science as we deal with the Bible? Bible writers rule out divination. Ezekiel 12:24 and Deuteronomy 18:10. The use of omens, very popular among the ancients, Jeremiah 10, verse 2. And whereas healing on occasion is attributed to the miraculous, Bible authors never claim that miraculous measures are required for healing. The very exercise of miracles was for a special purpose. And that purpose was not primarily in order that everybody might be healed. It was in order to prove that men had been sent on a mission by God Himself. The Bible writers suggest that even miraculous healings through human agents were not to occur perpetually, but were unique in human history. And that's evident from consideration of Paul's treatise regarding miraculous powers as a part of the spiritual gifts that we read about in 1 Corinthians 13, verses 7 through 11. Isn't it strange that of all the ancient writings, the Bible alone is free from the grotesque, unscientific perversions that were once passed off as medicine? The Bible is, as a medical historian notes, surprisingly rational. Well, the uniqueness of the Bible can't be determined, of course, solely on the basis of what it does not say. What do they actually say regarding medical materials and concepts? And so Brother Barfield investigates five general categories: sanitation laws, food laws, moral laws, laws relating to factors that cause stress, and laws concerning the practice of circumcision. Biblical sanitation laws were definitely unique in ancient literature. They were given without scientific error well over 3,000 years ago, a time when technology of the day was incapable of making such discoveries. In most instances, over 3,000 years passed between the original pronouncements and the pertinent scientific discoveries. In other words, they were announced 3,000 years before we came along and learned of their importance. The writers could not have known the significance of those writings. Little wonder that Moses has been characterized as the greatest sanitary engineer that the world has ever seen, and that the book of Leviticus has been tabbed as that fine treatise on hygiene. Sir M. Monier Williams spent nearly half a century in the study of Sanskrit and the Eastern religions. He admitted that he was impressed at first, but once given the writings equal footing with the Bible, those thoughts were wiped clean by intense study, and once gone, they never threatened again. Near the end of his study, he wrote, "These non-Christian Bibles are all developments in the wrong direction. They all begin with some flashes of true light and end in utter darkness. Pile them, if you will, on the left side of your table, but place your own Holy Bible on the right side, all by itself, all alone and with a wide gap between them. For there's a gulf between it and the so-called sacred books of the East, which severs the one from the other utterly, hopelessly, and forever. Not a mere rift across which the Christian may shake hands and interchange similar ideas in regard to essential truths, but a veritable gulf which cannot be bridged over by any science of religious thought, a bridgeless chasm which no theory can ever span." Well, the same thing is true when we investigate sacred revelations and astronomy. Throughout the world, ancient astronomers were more often wrong than they were right. And until about 1500 A.D., astronomy was an inextricable mass of confusion, someone has written. Barfield investigates astronomical errors in the Quran, the Hindu writings, Buddhist doctrine, Chinese religions, the Judeo-Christian extra-biblical writings, and large numbers of astronomical errors are to be found in these writings. C.F. Whitley admired the way biblical writers drew their distinctions between nature and the supernatural sphere. It's interesting to notice. The heavens were personified by the Mesopotamians as the god Anu, and they were regarded by the Egyptians as the divine mother. But to the Hebrews, they were but one aspect of Yahweh's power and glory. The Mesopotamians again conceived of the sun as Shamash, the god of justice. The Egyptians invested it with the properties of the divine creator. But the Hebrews merely accounted for it as one of the luminaries created by Yahweh. The moon was similarly worshipped by the Babylonians as the god Sin, and the stars were thought to determine the destiny of man. But to the Hebrews, they were created by God. The Hindu idea of this earth and its suspension in space was unusual. They thought of the earth as resting upon the backs of four giant elephants, who in turn stood upon the back of an even larger turtle, who swam leisurely in a sea of milk. This is the concept from the Hebrew and the Hindu sacred writings. I think of one of our contemporary scientists, who tells a rather amusing story. He appeared to present a lecture at one place dealing with the earth and the cosmos, encountered a lady after it was over who wanted to know what he thought held the earth up. Well, he sensed something coming, and so he asked, well, what do you think holds it up? She said, a giant turtle. Now, this is in our day. Well, the scientist was just ready to ask, well, what does that turtle stand on? When he said he noticed a glint in her eye, she waved her finger in his face and said, you're not getting me on that one. It's turtles all the way down. In other words, she could take it just as far as he wanted to go. Contrast that with the idea expressed in the book of Job, the 26th chapter and the 7th verse, where we read, he stretcheth out the north over empty space and hangeth the earth upon nothing. The earth is suspended in space without observable means of support. And how clear and how accurate that is. I think you find Brother Barfield's work interesting. I'd like to suggest that you look at it. This just gets us started on the things he's revealed. The work that went into that book has been tremendous. He's done an excellent job. And you'll come away with a refreshed idea of your faith in the Bible as the Word of the living God. Thank you.